Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, again, no comments today. I just hope they start rolling in, though. We could use a few comments. Well, in our last program, Brent Nottigall was with me, and we have been discussing the Balfour Declaration. And you know what I want to do today? I want to jump right back into it. Brent is back with me in the studio. And so welcome back, Brent.
Hi.
I just found our discussion fascinating. I think there was anything I could add before we get back into some other things is, of course, I think it's interesting for all of our listeners out there that have been following Korda's book. I think you remember from programs that we've had in the past is that really the Arabic peoples wanted to have the Jews come into the area because they knew they were skilled at raising crops. They were skilled at their mind for technology, and even today, Jewish technology is amazing. You know, with computers and electronics, and you know, even some of their defensive forces,
and their agriculture still to this day.
Yeah, I mean, they can get oranges and lemons and out of the soil over there. So they're doing really well. But I just one thing that I think that Schneer just brings up somewhat, and I think it's important to say is that there was kind of like an Arabism movement that was growing at the same time the Zionist movement was growing, but they were on different tracks. They didn't know what each other were doing, and that has been a problem, I think, in the Middle East. There's been a lot of secret things going on. And these Arabic societies were secret societies, and a lot of them were done by the young intellectuals. And they had their own plans. Now, Sharif Hussein had his plan, and of course he wanted to be, you know, head of it all. There's a lot of talk about, what McMahon was writing, or I think that's how you say his name. He was one of the British leaders, and what he wanted. And a lot of people will point at what he... The letters between he and Sharif Hussein, that they weren't really well written in Arabic, and there was a lot of misunderstanding of what was going to happen with Palestine. But it's these young intellectuals that really wanted to begin to exclude the Jews. And, I think there was at the very beginning, as you said, the last program, there was this brotherly feeling among them. And again, people were reading the Bible more then. Even if you look at Winston Churchill, I mean, he knew his Bible. Mm-hmm. I mean, he knew it. He wasn't necessarily the most religious guy on earth, but still he knew the Bible. But there was this, the secret society, and this Schneer brings out a pretty good quote about it. And one of the big leaders of that was a young Arab. His last name was Faruqi. And I guess they were talking about what was going to happen, you know, once the Turks were defeated. I mean, the Arabs wanted the Turks defeated. The English needed the Turks defeated. Even Sharif realized, you know, for him to realize his desire to be head of, you know, the head of the caliphate, you know, he needed to get the Turks out because the Turks were just oppressive and all that. But here's what Faruqi explained. It says, "As for the nature of the Arab state to be established," Faruqi explained, "the Arab countries are to be governed by the principles of decentralization, each country to have the sort of government which best suits it, but to be ruled by the central government, meaning the seat of the caliphate. Sharif Hussein of Mecca was to be the Khalifa and the Sultan of the new empire. Christians, Druze, and Arab would have the same rights as Muslims in the new state," he promised, "but the Jews would be governed by a special law." And so you can see there was that that attitude building in the young Arabs that they wanted to, it seems like to me, they wanted to corner the Jews into, another ghetto area in that area. You know, and of course, that's where the whole thing with Palestine, the name Palestine gets really popular because it kind of hides the fact it was Judah.
Well, if you go back, actually, and you look at the word Palestine and how it was approached before in the World War II, you had to be very specific if you were going to say Palestinian Arab or Palestinian Jew. Most of the Palestinians, as far as being used by that term, were Jews. We just think of them as being Arabs today. But the Jerusalem Post used to be called the Palestine Post because it was written by Jews, and Jews were there in Palestine. So we didn't have any of this attachment to a people. I mean, we know that Palestinian has never been there to describe a people until the last, let's say, around World War II or just before. So before then, during this time, it didn't even apply to them. We had really this period, and if they would just come together and recognize this, that even this period before Balfour and thereafter, eventually you would have the Arab revolt against the Jews there in the late 30s, and they would fight against them. And it was motivated by a few really anti-Semitic, distasteful leaders that were in charge. But at the end of the day, you had mass influx of Arabs through this period to the area of Palestine, or where the Jews were, because of the amazing opportunities that were being afforded to them by Jewish enterprise.
Right.
Jewish construction, Jewish building. They were turning the land into something that could be functional and flourish. And the Jews needed manpower to do this. And so you had massive amounts of Syrians that came down, Arabs from Syria, Arabs from the Transjordan, all of these areas that came and really did strengthen the numbers of the Arab population there in the land, which would eventually be called Palestinian. But most of those weren't originally inhabiting there. I'm not saying all of them weren't. I'm just saying that there, I think around Balfour, there was about 100,000 Jews in the area of Palestine, and there was about 400,000 Arabs. So they were outnumbered for sure by the Arabs, but there's still a sizable percentage of Jews before this agreement was even brought into place.
Right.
I do have this one quote that I might just mention while we're talking about here. This is from Faisal. He's the son of Hussein.
Right.
And he said this on March 19. This was after actually some meetings that were had with Wiseman, the head of the Zionist movement, and T. Lawrence himself. I mean, they were all there talking. And this is what Faisal wrote in 1919 on March 3rd, so shortly after the First World War. "We are working together for a reformed and revived Middle East, and our two movements complete one another. The Jewish movement is national, not imperialist. And there is room in Syria," and he conceived Syria, Palestine being a part of Syria at the time, just in greater Syria, I should say, "where for a short," he would rule there, "for us both." Basically, there's space for us both, and we're going to work together. And the Jews aren't imperialist. These are all things that the Arabs would say today that the Jews are. They don't want to work together with us. They want to take over our land. They are imperialist. And then he added this, "I think that neither can be a real success without the other."
Right.
Working together. Sadly, that's not what we've seen.
No. But, that's I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the last couple programs that we've been talking about. To me, the real problem in the Middle East is not the fact they're Arabs, not the fact that they're Palestinians, not the fact that they're Jews. The problem is human nature. They could be helping each other.
Mm-hmm.
There is this wacky part of human nature that we all want what we want, and we'll go after it the way we want to go after it. And unfortunately, at this time, it's all, the way to get it is violence. And, it's going to take the return of Christ to get all these problems really mm-hmm. solved. I mean, that's just the bottom line.
Sure.
I know we talked a little bit earlier this morning about, some of the things where, if you really look at World War One, Britain had to win this war in the East in order to preserve the Suez Canal. They had to win the war against the Turks, and they were definitely afraid of Germany getting control of the Suez Canal because, of the position where it was, and because the Turks had sided with the Germans and all that. So they knew they had to win. And so, but at the very beginning, they were not winning. And so So, but then you talked to me this morning about the Battle of Beersheba. I think it's a good thing for us to talk about now.
You know, yeah, because
on the program. I mean, it's. I think people need to understand it. I don't think Korda necessarily brings this out. You know.
Yeah, I think everything I've read over the past couple of years. I mean, I'm Australian, so and I'm in Israel, and this is the one thing that's really attached to Australian fighting force during World War One. And Israel, the Battle of Beersheba, which is done under the British flag, obviously, Australia being part of the Commonwealth. But this is basically where, you know, after the Suez and all of that, there was the decision that Britain did want to take Palestine, did want to get Jerusalem. It's going to be very hard to get there. They were trying to come up from the south, and they were stuck at Gaza, where there was a huge Turkish fortress right there. And so they decided to go inland from Gaza, which is basically where Gaza is today, and decide if they could take Beersheba first, where there was a bunch of different wells, that they could go up and get Jerusalem that way and then approach Gaza from a different direction. And what's interesting is at this very precise time that the Balfour Declaration is being deliberated, is actually being passed by the cabinet on October 31st, before it was delivered on November 2nd, that was the day of the successful taking of Beersheba by the Australian Light Horse. This is the last successful cavalry charge in wartime history. This is where 800 light horsemen had a field of 2 miles that they had to overcome under a barrage of cannon fire. So right. If you can imagine, I don't know if you've seen this, there's a movie, there's like a minute or 2 minute clip, I forget how long it is, but they've done really well in this film at showing you how long it would take for a horse to gallop these 2+ miles across this field while being attacked by this cannon fire. And then an amazing miracle, the horses just kept on coming. They were coming so fast that once they became closer, the snipers didn't put down their scopes. And so inside the trenches, inside Beersheba, so the Ottomans were just continually firing over the top of these 800 men that were trying to take a garrison of far more than that. And really, this was the last hope. If they didn't take it, their horses were going to die, and you know, they're in the middle of the desert. And so people look at that even today, and the Jews will look at that as a miracle, where this battle was allowed to proceed in the favor of the British Empire to oust the Turks. Now, after Beersheba was taken, the same day Balfour is basically agreed upon, that's when Allenby goes trucks further north and starts to move on Jerusalem, which he eventually takes a couple months later. And so really there's this big change of the tide in terms of the war effort at exactly the same time that Balfour is coming about. And I think there's miracles in both of those instances,
right,
that would allow the fact for the Brits, for the Jews to actually be there. I mean, there's no hope for a Jewish homeland under the Ottoman rule or even the German rule. It's probably not going to happen.
Right.
And so if we're going to get the return of the Jewish people to their native homeland to fulfill countless prophecies in the Bible, they have to take this land. And they have to become a state eventually, and so that they can act in that capacity. And so it's no surprise then that you find miracles attached to the most important event, let's say, in terms of Jewish statehood. It wasn't statehood in 1948. That would have never come about if not for the Balfour Declaration, the Brits taking over this territory. Flaws as they had, the Brits, we can see God's hand moving in the tide of the affairs of men. We've been talking about that a lot right now.
That's right.
But you read this history of Balfour, and you have just secular men looking at this saying that there's a window in time for about 5 years that this could have happened, and that window is not going to open again. I wonder if I can just have one quote along those lines. History of the Jews by Paul Johnson, just a famous book.
Yeah.
He says this: the Balfour Declaration was the key piece in the jigsaw puzzle, for without it, the Jewish state could never have come into existence. And then he talks about all these other things that were coming together. And then he writes this: if the Arabs as a whole had been properly organized diplomatically during the war, if the Palestinian Arabs had been organized at all, there is no slightest doubt that the declaration would never have been issued. So he's talking about how there was disruption in their cause, which allowed the Jews to come. Even 12 months later, it would have been impossible to release the Balfour. It was, as Wiseman pulled the Zionists through a brief window of time, fated never to open again. he received perhaps the last ex grata gift of a great power which went clean against the arithmetical aid, spirit of the age. It didn't add up mathematically that this is going to go through. Britain had to win it. The Jews had to have Balfour. Jerusalem had to be taken. And it all happened within the space of a year, which allowed for the establishment of the Jewish state eventually.
Right. That's one of the, when I read that quote earlier, the last program, that's one of the unseen forces that people
right.
can't see.
Right.
Is that God wanted this to happen. And of course, I think the one of the books that I know I've recommended in the past and still recommend people read is United States and Britain in Prophecy. I mean, these are prophecies being fulfilled, and the Jews had to return to their homeland. And the point is, I mean, we have a lot of, supposed Christian people that read their Bibles, but they forget that Jesus Christ is going to return to the Mount of Olives and take back Jerusalem.
Right.
I mean, this is what God wants. He chose Jerusalem. This is God's city. This is God's area. And, there's great history being worked out here, great prophecies being worked out here. And so, this Balfour Declaration is kind of a miraculous thing. And, of course, then the taking of Beersheba. I mean, if you know anything about the history of Beersheba, who was the one that first was there?
Right, Abraham.
Abraham. Mm-hmm. And then Isaac spent time there, mm-hmm. and Jacob spent time there. I mean, Beersheba is an incredibly important area geographically, but also biblically. And so it's not surprising that an Israelite nation takes it,
right?
From the Turks. Again, that should it should really just put chills up and down people's spines. I know it does me, when I think about it. And so there's absolutely nothing wrong with being a Bible reader, and especially those of us that have been given the grace to understand it. I mean, it is a phenomenal book. And, when we look at these things in history, we can see things playing out that are just phenomenal. And it really should build your faith and your hope and, that eventually all this is going to get really, really fixed. So I think that's just really great. So I think we also want to just show that I think maybe we've talked about it a little bit, but there was really support from the Arabs for the Balfour Declaration at the very beginning. And so why is there so much anti-Arab feeling now? Obviously, it's the degeneration of human nature. It's the liberal mindset that has kind of gripped United States. It's gripping, tiny Judah, or is Israel today. It's really misnamed, but it's really tiny Judah. The liberals are getting in charge, and of course, we're not embarrassed to say that Satan, the devil, and his demons are motivating all of it.
Right, especially in terms of the anti-Semitic fervor that exists, I would say, to a far greater degree inside the Arab world today.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't explain it. I mean, you talk to many Israelis, or I do, and a really critical question to ask if they want to discuss it is the origins of this deep-seated hatred that the latest revival of it is now amongst the Arab world in general, and ask them where it comes from, and they'll all have different ideas. But I think Mr. Flory, in his book, The Key of David, he talks about the true origins of anti-Semitism and really puts that squarely at the hands of Satan, who does have a hatred for the Jews specifically because they haven't forgotten a lot of their history. They
right.
they do know who they are. They're one of the tribes. They're not one of the lost 10 tribes because they're not lost, because they held on to those truths like the Sabbath and
right.
and the holy days and things like that. And they have been persecuted for it. And that's been part of Satan's wrath against them for so long.
Right.
And so that's why, again, to see God working through one of the birthright nations to allow them to have a little bit of a safe zone
right.
from such an onslaught of anti-Semitism that they faced historically is an amazing gift from them. Now, it gets to the certain point now where Israel feels incredibly safe because they have their own nation and it has been a safety for them. But the Arabs see that not necessarily as a bad thing. They just think all the Jews are in one spot now, and so it might be easy to get them looking at it that way.
Yeah. So I guess in some ways you've had a unique view over in Jerusalem because obviously you've worked with Dr. Mazar, who is Jewish, also a descendant of King David, which is really exciting. But I think on digs you've also worked with Arabic peoples.
Oh yeah, Arabs, Jews. I mean, it's. I actually give a lecture in one of the classes here that I talk about not every Arab, you know, it's a horrible title for a lecture, but it grabs attention. You know, not every Arab wants to kill you because it just shows that fundamentally these are all human beings that have varying degrees of being, I'd say, susceptible to either, I would say, maybe influence by other people or but every Arab that I've come across in Israel on a day-to-day basis has been willing to talk with me and converse and work next to each other. And they, you know, I might see the hostility that does really come out when you see, you know, some of the Muslim leaders that are inciting the violence of their people inside and making up lies about the Jewish people. Then you have all the Arabs that are rising up for that. But many times at the end of the day, that Arab that's working alongside of you or that's building the property that you live on or something like that, he's trying to find some money to bring food home to his family. So fundamentally, I feel like it is a problem with human nature, one, but then human nature, as it reveals itself in the leadership of these nations and the greedy, selfish leadership that is willing to use the population for its goals. And you see that back in during 19, 15, 16, 17. Right. And you see it today where I would say the everyday people are kind of held captive in a way to their leaders that are quite selfish.
Right. Right. I mean, the thing is, I think the one other quote that I could add from this new book, again, by Jonathan Schneer, I guess it is, but again, it's the Balfour Declaration. And I'm going to say the book has two titles because then it's the subtitle there is The Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. But I think it'd be a better title of the book. Just take the Balfour Declaration off and just say The Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict.
Yeah.
because the Balfour Declaration is not the origin, but there's a lot of other origins that are there. And he does make a good quote on page 39. It says, "The early wartime correspondence sowed seeds of future difficulties, but also displays the reluctance of at least some British officers in situ to engage in ambiguities and sophistries." And so that eventually that began to happen where, you know, the people were being duplicitous with each other. And even Corder brings out that T.E. Lawrence, for as much as he was taught not to lie, when it was convenient for his purposes, he was duplicitous, even with his own bosses like Kitchener and all that. He said, but these were the early days. Once the French became involved, there he's going to pick on the French again, and the Russians and the Italians and the Zionists, the opportunities for obfuscation and double dealing would multiply. And I think this is a great end to this comment here. It says it would lead some British officers nearly to despair. I mean, some of the British officers knew what eventually was taking place, and it was wrong. And, of course, T.E. Lawrence was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he had his own part. His was more with his own commanders because he believed he knew better than everybody else anyway. But he saw what was happening and how there was double dealing with the Arabs, and there was just double dealing everywhere. And, you know, the French wanted what they want. The Russians wanted what they wanted. The Italians wanted what they wanted. I mean, some of these people from a religious standpoint had wanted to keep their holy shrines in Jerusalem. The Russians wanted to keep their, you know, their areas of Jerusalem for themselves. And so, that's kind of what happens with everything in our society. It's that selfishness, that inner selfishness to get what we want. Or to, you know, just the French just felt like they deserved Lebanon and Syria along the Mediterranean. And, of course, Beirut, you know, they did. That at one time was the most, one of the most beautiful cities in the Middle East.
Right.
But now look at it. It's like a nightmare, mm-hmm. you know. So I think there's so many lessons that we can learn from this. But the Balfour Declaration, that was not a bad document.
Not at all. And I think, you know, through all that double dealing, we see God's will being able to play out through it, even with carnal man.
Isn't yeah, it? He's the master. Sure. God gets what he wants. And he'll work in history. And so I think we have a lot of things still left to see. And so again, all of you listeners out there, if you've not read The United States and Britain in Prophecy, you can certainly get a copy from thetrumpet.com, and it's sent to you free. You know, you can even download it for yourself, so you don't have to write us and reveal your address if you don't want to. But it's still... it's probably one of the most phenomenal books you ever read, if you just open your mind to it. Well, it seems like that's all we have time for today's program. And so next time we'll get back to Michael Korda's book. And we'll be very thankful, Brent, that you were here. We thank you for coming.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
And we'll be checking on you every now and then with Watch Jerusalem. Of course, you have the magazine now coming out. So
final touches being
yeah,
put on it now.
That's a lot of work. I know it is. So remember, we are rapidly concluding our series of programs on T.E. Lawrence using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. Next program, I'll tell you what we're going to finish with the book and what we're not going to finish. And then in the first week of November, we're going to begin a new series, which I'm really looking forward to doing. And that series is titled A Tribute to Charles Krauthammer. We'll be reading major parts of his book of essays titled Things That Matter. And you can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at avebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. If you don't want to write them to me, you can write them to Brent. We'll make sure he hears them. So you can also follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.